I said, no, it's reporters. They're my friends. When he offered the journalists guns of their own, they politely declined. Gettleman marveled at how comfortable Clausen seemed to feel, operating in what appeared to be an environment entirely hostile to foreign companies. I worked all around Somalia, and Galkayo is always one of the scariest places, he said. It was also starting to develop a reputation as a place where Westerners were potential targets for lucrative kidnappings. It had a bad vibe, just nobody was in control. These guys were taking advantage of the lawlessness to say, fuck it, we'll get our own guns, we'll go wherever we want. They were like white pirates. Gettleman was left puzzled by Clausen's operation, with no way of knowing that he was in the middle of a burgeoning criminal cartel being hunted by the U.S. government. I got the vibe that he was almost earnest about the work, he said of Clausen. He had respect, and he seemed interested in Somalia and excited to be there. I also thought, if what they were doing was illegitimate, why would they let us stay with them? If they're running a criminal enterprise, why would they invite us in? The next morning, the group accepted a ride back to the airport and flew out. When Gettleman won a Pulitzer Prize for his reporting on Somalia 3 years later, Clausen sent him a congratulatory note. Whether LaRue's intentions for Somalia changed, or he was just slowly rolling out a plan he'd had all along, Clausen wasn't sure. But late in 2009, he felt his boss's priorities shift. The fishing project was burning $50,000 to $100,000 a month, LaRue said, and it was time for self-sufficiency. Fortunately, he had plans for how to create it. For starters, he'd had Clausen arrange for a license to import and export prescription drugs in bulk, supplementing the pharmacy recruitment network he'd built for Rx Limited, and resell them in Europe or the United States. That was just the beginning. The Somali operation, he announced, would become sustainable by growing drugs. He began shipping in seeds to experiment with. Poppies, codename carrots, as LaRue established in one email to Clausen. Cannabis, beans, and coca, mustard. He also hired a Filipino agriculture expert and shipped him to Galkayo, where he converted a room in the compound into a mini greenhouse for test plantings, while LaRue arranged for a large-scale version to be imported. LaRue sent obsessively detailed plans about how to set up the operation, including the required pressure for the irrigation systems, initial fertilization quantities, space between planting rows, and water needed per day. Also, there's no soil in Somalia suitable for growing drugs, Clausen said. So we had to basically import loads and loads of soil and fertilize it constantly. No matter, LaRue was already barreling ahead, forwarding resumes of chemists and agriculturalists that he could hire to ramp up production. LaRue then devised still another money-making scheme, inspired by the Somali pirates who were now their partners. His plan, Clausen said, was to send some special speedboats, military-grade, high horsepower, to basically go to the Seychelles, kidnap some rich people, bring them back to Somalia, hold them hostage until they paid ransom, then let them go. Pirate style. Because he loved what the pirates did. For him, that was genius. That was fast money, with almost no expense. As LaRue's ambitions ballooned, so too did his assessment of the weapons it would require to carry them out. In November 2009, LaRue sent a detailed list of weapons he'd purchased for shipment into the country. 20mm Gatling gun times 10. Grenade launcher times 40. 81mm mortars times 50. Mixture of detonators times 100. Anti-personnel landmines times 200. RPG rounds times 1,000. And on and on. The arms would be flown in from Ukraine on a Russian Antonov cargo plane, a favorite of international arms dealers. Clausen prepared a security force of 100 men to guard the plane's unloading. At the last minute, the pilots balked at the size of the runway and canceled the flight. To Clausen, LaRue's ideas were growing more erratic and grandiose by the month. LaRue wanted to make roomfuls of money in Somalia, he told Clausen. Boxes of cash so voluminous that they wouldn't be able to store them. He wanted to control his own country so he could operate with complete freedom. Ultimately, it wasn't just profits he wanted, but power, unfettered by any government. He wanted to be the king of his country. That was his major dream, Clausen said. The big man, sitting on his fat ass behind a giant desk in his palace. Clausen could never understand why LaRue couldn't just stick to the plan. He would have made millions and millions of dollars every month in Somalia legally, he said. The tuna business really was there for the taking. And after that, there was oil. Decades before, American oil companies had prospected in a more stable Somalia, believing it had significant oil reserves to exploit. They'd fled after the overthrow of the country's pro-American dictator in 1991, and LaRue claimed to have come into possession of coordinates indicating where the Americans had drilled. There could be untold riches under the ground that Southern Ace, with its protective force, would be uniquely positioned to liberate. LaRue purchased a small drilling rig and had it shipped to Somalia. When Clausen and his men tried it, they discovered that he'd bought one insufficiently deep to strike oil. Clausen was beginning to realize that LaRue's appetites were too great to be satisfied by long-term returns. He didn't have the patience, Clausen said. It had to happen now, not next year, not in 6 months, no, now. Over the course of 2010, Clausen began spending more and more time overseeing the Somalia business remotely, from Dubai. LaRue didn't complain, since the operations banking was conducted in the city, and much of its equipment was either purchased or shipped through it. The strain of his remote posting had ended Clausen's marriage in the Philippines, and he started seeing a woman in Dubai. The longer he was away from Galkayo, the more his doubts crept in. Navigating between the day-to-day chaos on the ground and LaRue's capricious demands had become exhausting. One of the compound's cars was hit by an improvised explosive device while Clausen was away. No one was killed, but several of the guards had ruptured eardrums. When LaRue insisted they could be treated at local hospitals, Clausen secretly rearranged the budget to fly them to Djibouti for treatment on the company's dime. Worse than the trials of running the operation, for Clausen, was the feeling that he had begun sliding into moral purgatory. He had long been acutely aware of, and working alongside, LaRue's violence and criminality. But the new proposals for Somalia felt different. With LaRue's cultivation scheme, Clausen was potentially becoming an international drug producer. The Seychelles' tourist kidnapping plan was even worse. It would cast Clausen into a role no different than that of violent thugs like Joseph Hunter. In Dubai, Clausen finally talked to his girlfriend about his concerns. "She had a basic knowledge of what I was doing, not in detail," he said. She said, "Do what you have to do. Follow what your heart says, or what your mind says in this case." She would understand if he wanted to keep working for LaRue, she told him. "But if I was you, I would walk away from it." That was enough for Clausen. He flew back to Galkayo, and a few days later roused the entire compound in the middle of the night, announcing that his mother had a medical emergency. He had to be on the next plane out. There was a UN aid flight leaving in the morning, and Clausen talked the pilot into letting him ride his cargo. "And off I was. I was gone," he said. "When I arrived in Dubai, I felt so relieved. But of course, then the trouble only started." After about a week, Clausen called LaRue to inform him that he wasn't coming back. "It's getting out of hand," he told his boss. "It's crossing lines that I don't want to cross. I'm done." LaRue wasn't angry, not at first. "Okay, no problem," is all Clausen remembered him saying. But with Clausen's departure, and the Somalian operation now in the hands of the likes of Agent Orange, the wheels started coming off. Money disappeared, and the local security forces' monthly salaries became irregular. Clausen kept in contact with his former employees, and then suddenly they went dark. An email to his British deputy prompted a reply from a newly created anonymous address. "Hey buddy, sorry, but I can't talk to you," the deputy wrote. "You gotta understand, I don't want to end up dead." Then Clausen got a call from his old friend Chris DeMeyer, who was still working for LaRue in Manila. "There's a hit on you," DeMeyer said. "A what?" "Yeah, apparently LaRue put a hit on you." "Why?" "It's about things that happened in Somalia. Joe was on his way to Dubai." Joe meant Hunter, which meant that Clausen was in deep shit. They'd had a pact, Clausen remembered. If LaRue ever asked one of them to kill another, they'd let each other know, and then fake the killing. Hunter, apparently, had decided not to honor it. Clausen hung up the phone and started making calculations. Hunter would have trouble getting to him at home in Dubai, where he lived in a secure building, in a condo rented from his girlfriend's employer. Instead, he'd likely try to take Clausen out in the street. Hunter was a killer, a trained sniper. He wasn't someone to just sit and wait for. Clausen looked up the last number he'd had for LaRue and dialed it. LaRue picked up. "It's me," Clausen said. "What's going on?" "What do you mean, what's going on?" "Yeah, what's Joe coming to do?" LaRue said he didn't know what Clausen was talking about. "I know there's a hit on me," Clausen said. Give me a reason. Tell me why. If you're going to kill me, tell me why. I want to know if I died for an illusion or for a stupid reason. Or maybe you're mentally ill, I don't know. LaRue stopped playing dumb. I did an investigation, he said. $300,000 had gone missing from the Somalian operation. The remaining employees had pointed to Clausen. LaRue cited as proof the condominium that Clausen was living in Dubai. Listen, I'll send you all the documents, the financial reports, Clausen said. Every dollar is accounted for during the period I was there. So please, I know you're smart enough, I know nobody can cheat you, but check them again. I'm going to call you back in 2 days, and you tell me again that I took $300,000. If you can show me $1 that I took from you, send Joe, it's fine. But make sure he's ready, because I'm going to wait for him. He hung up the phone and emailed LaRue the records he'd maintained on the project, including a list of serial numbers of all the cash ever spent under his watch. Then Clausen looked up the website of the CIA, the first agency that popped into his head, and sent an email to a generic address. In it, he reported that he'd worked for a man named Paul LaRue, that he had information about large-scale international criminality, and that he was willing to talk. No one replied. A few days later, Clausen called LaRue back, and before he could say anything, Clausen launched into a prepared speech. I forgot to say, you called that dog back because I have a backup of all the information that I know about you. Your family in the Netherlands, everything. And it's going to go out if something happens to me. He'd heard something similar in a movie. He hung up, then called back a few hours later. Okay, I apologize, I shouldn't have said that. But what did you find out about the money I took? Well, I was going to apologize to you, because you're right. You didn't, LaRue said. It doesn't make sense. The dates on the reports LaRue had received from the guys still in Somalia didn't match the originals that Clausen had saved. The evidence that Clausen had stolen the funds, in other words, had been forged. I told Joe already, called him to come back, LaRue said. Then the man who had just ordered a hit on Clausen instead offered him a job, managing the pharmaceutical side of the business at a salary of $40,000 a month. Come to Manila and let's talk, he said. Clausen declined. Listen, you have my word, nothing's going to happen to you, LaRue said. You want a job? Call me. Clausen wasn't naive enough to trust LaRue, but he felt hopeful that he had finally escaped the organization. I walked out at the right time without breaking too many laws, or serious laws, he said. At least for now, he'd managed to wriggle out from under the hit. But he still seethed with the feeling that he had been betrayed, that after all he'd done and all he'd overlooked, his boss had ordered him dead on an ill-informed whim. He lost my respect by ordering a hit on me, Clausen said. When I threatened him that I was going to give him up, I meant it. I meant every single word of that. Apparently, he didn't take that seriously enough. Chapter 17. The Investigators. 2009 to 2010. More Ufuk ripples. Captain Bruce wants to talk. LaRue makes a list. Brill goes it alone. A source goes quiet. In late August 2009, only a few weeks after returning from meeting with law enforcement in the Philippines, Kent Bailey got a call from a contact at the Australian Federal Police. He'd been exchanging information with the AFP after discovering the Australians had also been investigating LaRue, who held an Australian passport from his first marriage. Now the Aussies were calling with a significant break. Kent, have you seen what just happened in the Philippines? The AFP contact said. The Philippine authorities had interdicted a ship called the MV Ufuk and discovered a cache of weapons on board. A classified cable from the U.S. Embassy in Jakarta, where the shipment originated, followed, reporting that the arms had been legally purchased from a company called PT Pindad and authorized by the Indonesian Ministry of Defense. The guns were invoiced for a Philippine company called RWB Arms. Within hours, Bailey was on the phone with Filipino counterparts he'd met on his trip to Manila. They reported back to him that the ship was licensed to La Plata Trading, and that the gun's destination was Red, White, and Blue Arms. The cargo manifest named Nelson Del Rosario, a.k.a. Nestor Del Rosario, and Michael Lontoc, a well-known competition target shooter, as the recipients. The names were instantly familiar to Bailey. They were already part of the intricate map of LaRue's operation that Kimberly Brill and Stephen Holdren had created in Minneapolis. The website registrations, the shell companies, and the figures connected to them. All the pieces started falling together, Bailey said. Within 24 hours, we knew it was LaRue. The seizure would finally give them hard evidence that he was more than just an online criminal. Bailey watched the case develop from afar, in part through Mar Supnad's stories in the local press. The UFOX captain, Bruce Jones, was telling Supnad he was ready to tell authorities everything about the syndicate behind the shipment. He'd even surrendered to the Philippines Bureau of Customs and requested that they place him in witness protection. Finally, Bailey thought, they might have the insider they had been seeking. Working through the Australian agents, he tried to reach Jones, first to tell him to shut the fuck up, as Bailey recalled. We were like, dude, we'll be lucky if you don't get killed before we get a hold of you. When the Australians finally made contact with Jones, they were able to meet with him twice to hear what he had. A lot of that was confirmation of what we knew, that LaRue was behind all this, Bailey said. Jones suggested he might put up a website with everything he knew. But the Australians got the impression that Jones wasn't fully cooperating, and he was released back onto the street. In the meantime, the DEA investigators did manage to engineer one break. The team put together a presentation laying out why LaRue should be added to the U.S. Attorney General's Consolidated Priority Organization Target List, or CPOT, an internal index of the DOJ's most wanted drug criminals. There were roughly 50 to 60 CPOT designees at any given time, people considered members of the most prolific international drug trafficking and money laundering organizations by the DEA, like the Sinaloa cartel head Joaquin El Chapo Guzman. With the UFOX arms case in hand, the team working RX Limited finally had enough to make a case that LaRue deserved to be among them. He wasn't just a guy peddling pills online, they could now show. He was a new kind of drug kingpin, traveling seamlessly from the world of online pharmacies to that of major arms trafficking. That was an aha moment, Bailey said. That was the first time I could put stuff in that frickin' PowerPoint that said, what I've been saying, this is the proof. In May 2010, Brill and Holdren flew to Washington, D.C. to present before a Department of Justice review board that votes on CPOT designations. When they finished, the board handed down its decision. LaRue would be placed on the list. After years of Brill and Holdren trying to explain the power of LaRue's convoluted, highly technical network, the powers that be finally acknowledged that their hunches about his significance had been right all along. That night, Holdren told Brill he was leaving the DEA for a job as a criminal investigator at the Federal Housing and Urban Development Agency. They'd been working the LaRue case for nearly 3 years, and Holdren was looking for a new challenge. In Minneapolis, Brill would have to go it alone. In her hotel room, Brill allowed herself a few minutes of despair. It was purely out of exhaustion, she said. We had gotten this extra focus on the case and raised it to a higher level, and I already knew what that was going to mean. Now there were some additional expectations, and it was kind of an overwhelming feeling that I was going to have to figure these things out, and I wasn't sure I could do it on my own. And then, she said, I got over it. The CPOT designation was a calling card that would open doors in other departments and agencies and bring additional resources. But they still needed that one missing piece to make the case against LaRue, someone from the inside. 2 months later, Bailey got another call from the Australian authorities with bad news. The ship captain Jones had been arrested for weapons and drug possession. The Australians tracked him down in jail, where he told him it was all a setup. In a brazen attempt to play both sides, he had met with Dave Smith, hoping to recoup the rest of his fee for piloting the boat. Jones still wanted to get paid. I think he was supposed to get paid 50 grand, Bailey said. So he'd gone to Smith to plead his case. Hey, I delivered the boat. I can't help it if it was seized. In a court of law, in a legitimate deal, he would have been ordered to be paid, but you can't go to a real court. The two argued until finally Smith agreed to pay the money. He called someone whom Jones assumed to be LaRue, then told Jones the money would be placed in a paper bag in his truck outside the bar. When Jones walked out and retrieved the bag, he found not $50,000, but 2 ounces of meth and a gun. Moments later, the Philippine police swooped in and arrested him. Bailey and the Australians discussed their options. If they got Jones out of jail, they feared Smith and LaRue might move it to the next level to silence him. But Jones wanted out, and they decided to hope that their would-be informant wouldn't put himself right back in danger. According to Bailey, he and the Australians decided to spring Jones from jail. The Australian Federal Police denied having any role in the release, suggesting instead that LaRue's organization was responsible. For a while, Jones heeded the agent's advice to stay under the radar. By September 2010, it had been a year since the Ufuk, with no arrests in the case. Jones decided to venture out, confident, the reporter Mar Supnad said, that the syndicate was no longer running after him. On the morning of September 21st, he drove his wife, Maricel, and young son to the Marquee Mall in Angeles City, the former site of U.S. military base 2 hours north of Manila. They were meeting friends, an American named John Nash and his wife, for lunch. Jones and Nash knew each other from the expat circles in Subic Bay, where Nash ran a security company. Among other things, his company supplied bouncers for local bars, including one called Blue Rock Resort in Beloit Beach, frequented by Dave Smith, and security for a SeaWorld-type aquatic animal park called Ocean Adventure. Nash had a reputation as a particular kind of problem solver. He was known for placing his pistol on the table at the beginning of a negotiation, one acquaintance said, and spoke 5 Filipino dialects fluently. At around 2 p.m., the group departed from lunch. Jones and his wife in their gray Mitsubishi Lancer, their toddler in the back seat, with Nash following a few minutes behind. They planned to meet up again at the nearby Mountain Clark firing range, where Nash was a regular. As Jones turned down a narrow residential road, 100 feet from the entrance to the gun range, a red Honda XRM motorcycle pulled up behind him, carrying 2 men in helmets, riding in tandem. The vehicles approached a speed bump, and the motorcycle zoomed in front, blocking the car's path. The man on the back leaped off, approached the car, pulled out a handgun, and fired into the driver's side window. The gunman then climbed back on the motorcycle, and the men sped off. Jones was hit multiple times. One bullet passed through his body and struck Maricel in the back. He fell over on top of her, vomiting blood. Maricel froze, terrified, and then opened the door and climbed out. She frantically called Nash, who raced down the road to where Jones's Lancer idled. He pulled Maricel and her son into his car and drove to the hospital. The baby was unhurt, and doctors were able to stabilize Maricel. Jones died slumped across the passenger seat, his wife's shoes still on the floor next to him. According to the police report, investigators found 4 45 caliber shell casings near the car, but little other evidence. Tandem motorcycle riders are a common style of assassination in the Philippines, not least because helmeted killers can speed off without being identified. Police questioned Nash, who gave his full name as John William Nash Jr., a 49-year-old American working as a consultant in the Subic Bay area. Nash told police that he and his wife had lingered for a minute after lunch, putting some packages in the trunk of their car. He received the call from Maricel and arrived to find Bruce already bloodied and lying at the front seat of his car. Nash said that Jones had told him previously that he'd received death threats and noticed strangers near his home who Jones believed were connected to his employers on the Ufuk. Back in England, where Jones had grown up, locals grieved a man they called a lovable rogue. The captain left behind 4 children, 2 in the United Kingdom and 2 in the Philippines. He was an amazing chap, an old friend from home told a Bristol newspaper. Unfortunately, he obviously ended up falling into the wrong circles. Kent Bailey had never met Jones, and he mourned a different kind of loss. Their best chance at an informant had just slipped away. They'd have to find someone else. Chapter 18. The Reporter. 2015 to 2017. On the trail of a killing. The bodies pile up. A Philippine officer presses the case. Corruption at the top. An ocean adventure. When I arrived here, he was already dead, said Roberto Manuel, the Philippine police officer who had been the first at the scene of Bruce Jones's murder. We were standing on a crumbling road outside of Angeles City in December 2015, where Manuel had come upon Jones' blood-soaked car, still running, 5 years earlier. Occasionally we were interrupted by the audible pop-pop of the gun range 100 feet down the road, the same one where Jones had been headed after lunch with John Nash. Manuel pulled out some crime scene photos he'd taken on his phone that day. With hand motions, he demonstrated exactly how far from Jones's window the gunman must have been standing when he fired. Close enough to ensure accuracy, he said, but not so close as to shatter the window, which was left with 4 bullet holes. By the time Manuel arrived, John Nash had already left the scene, taking Jones's wife and son to the hospital and leaving Jones to bleed out in the front seat of his car. Like many dramas surrounding LaRue, the Jones murder seemed to contain mysteries within other mysteries, unexplained characters who surfaced suddenly, played a role, and then disappeared. I decided to go see Bruce Jones's lawyer, Joe Frank Zuniga. He had brokered the meeting between Jones and the journalist Mar Supnad, and at the time of Jones's death, he reportedly had been negotiating police protection in exchange for Jones telling his story. I wondered if he might recall anything else Jones had said about his dealings with LaRue. But when I went online to find his address, the first Google result was a headline from a Philippine news site proclaiming that Zuniga himself had gone missing. According to the article, from July 2012, one morning that June, Zuniga left home for a meeting with a client in Subic Bay and hadn't been seen since. Wondering who else connected to the MV Ufuk had turned up dead, I headed to the Manila office of the National Bureau of Investigation to meet with Peter Lugay, the chief of the MBI Special Task Force investigating the Zuniga case. The details were relatively sparse, he told me. At 11:45 on the morning of June 20th, Zuniga was seen in the Subic Bay area after a meeting with two men. One of them was Timothy Desmond, CEO of the company that operated Ocean Adventure, the aquatic animal park. Desmond, an American animal behaviorist, had made his name training the killer whale in the movie Free Willy. The other man was the head of security for Ocean Adventure, John Nash. Nash and Zuniga were close, Lugay told me. They called each other compadre. Around the time of the meeting, a witness reported seeing a man near Zuniga's car being dragged into a white van. Unfortunately, Lugay said, I think we can safely assume that he is dead. A colleague of Lugay's told me that since taking on the Zuniga case, they had been trying to understand the connections between the disappearances and the MV Ufuk. Have you encountered the name Herbert Tan Chu? He asked me. I hadn't, so he filled me in. Acting on a tip in early October 2010, 2 months after the Jones murder, the Philippine National Police raided Chu's house and discovered a cache of Indonesian-made assault rifles they suspected had come from the MV Ufuk. What happened to Chu? I asked. He is also missing, Lugay said. Next, Lugay's colleague asked me if I'd ever heard of Michael Lontok. I hadn't. It turned out he was the world-class Philippine target shooter listed as the owner of Red, White, and Blue Arms. His name had also surfaced publicly in the Ufuk case. By now, I could guess the end of Lontok's story. One afternoon in September 2011, a year after the murder of Bruce Jones, Lontok had been driving home from a shooting competition in a Manila suburb. As he slowed down at a busy intersection, he received a call on his cell phone. Simultaneously, four men surrounded his pickup truck, firing into it with an Uzi and several handguns. He drove another 100 feet before slamming into a concrete wall and died on the scene. Unsurprisingly, with witnesses and informants disappearing, the investigation into the owners of the Ufuk fizzled. The Georgian crew members were deported back to their home country. A Philippine court declared that the remaining cases, including one against Johan, aka Paul Leroux, and his top deputies, had been archived. Only one participant, the South African ship captain Lawrence John Byrne, was tried and convicted in absentia after jumping bail. One former employee of LaRue's later estimated to me that LaRue had spent millions making the case go away, funneled through a Filipina lawyer. The source believed he had bought off contacts at the highest level of the government and paid to have certain friendly officials installed in powerful posts. Another told me that LaRue had hired a former NBI official to take charge of distributing bribes to law enforcement. He even had a desk at the company's call center at the BDO building in Makati. Yet another told me that Joe Frank Zuniga had been part of the syndicate all along. He had actually been in charge of the bribes aimed at keeping the MV Ufuk untouched and was killed because he kept a piece for himself. Sitting in the MBI office, I suddenly felt lost in the maze of graft and murders, where every new branch seemed to lead back to LaRue. Could I even trust the accounts of the agents sitting across from me? I was no longer sure. The only thing I knew for certain was that LaRue had operated here with a staggering level of impunity. I don't know how deep this goes, Lugay told me. We tried to talk to the prosecutor to set up a meeting about the case, and you know what the prosecutor said? Tell your boss I'm not talking to him, because people disappear in this case. By now I was so far down the rabbit hole that there seemed nothing to do but press on, looking for some semblance of logic on the other side. Together with Aurora Almendral, the reporter I'd been working with in Manila, I eventually tracked down one of the Philippine National Police officers who had investigated the Herbert Tan Chu case in late 2010. The officer had long since been transferred to a small city an hour's flight outside Manila. He would only talk, he said, if Almendral and I came to see him in person. When our flight landed at a single runway airport nestled in the mountains, a pair of officers picked us up in a black Chevy Blazer and drove us out to the local headquarters, a series of white block buildings spread across a kind of campus. The officer, whom I'll call Inspector R, was now a regional police coordinator here. It was a Sunday, and he greeted us in orange shorts and running shoes, along with what looked to be a bike racing jersey, white and blue with a PNP patch on one arm. On his desk were a series of neatly stacked reports marked confidential and secret. We sat down across from him, and as he talked, he toyed with a pair of cell phones sitting on his desk. In English, he explained that he just returned from a special assignment in Mindanao, an island in the south where the Philippine government was fighting a pitched battle against religious extremists loyal to ISIS. These days, he explained, the biggest targets in the Philippines were drug dealers who steered their profits to the militants. When I started to ask Inspector R about the Chu case, he immediately cut me off. "You know what you're looking into. It is very dangerous," he said. "These are very connected people. You should know that." If we wanted the truth, he said, we would have to keep his name out of it. I asked him why the case had stalled. "I'll be very straight. It boils down to Paul LaRue," he said. "He has lots of connections in the government, people that told me I have to slow down because it could put my family in danger. There were lots of policemen who would not do this case, and there were lots of senior officers who were his friends." The Chu case started, he explained, with a tip in October 2010, a few weeks after Bruce Jones was murdered. "There was a Filipino guy who contacted my office, said there's a Chinese guy who wants to sell guns," he said. "A raid on Chu's apartment produced 14 automatic weapons stashed around the house and in the ceiling tiles, all the exact same kind of Indonesian-made assault rifles that had been discovered during the Ufuk incident. Chu's cell phone was full of photos of weapons, gold bars, and Ferraris, and the officers took him into custody." That, Inspector R said, was when he first crossed paths with LaRue. At the station, Chu was allowed to use his phone to call a lawyer. Then he made a second call and handed the phone to Inspector R. On the other end was a man speaking accented English, who Inspector R later surmised was Paul LaRue. "I see you have Herbert," he said. "You could be a good friend. What do you want?" "I'll give you anything you want. You want my Mercedes-Benz? I'll give it to you. You choose." Inspector R said he declined, telling the man that he planned to file a case against Chu. "Okay, I'll send a lawyer," LaRue said, and hung up. Clearly, Chu was tied into something much larger than a few gun sales. On his phone, the police also found calls back and forth to a number listed as Dave Smith. Inspector R began piecing together the network behind the Ufuk, Bruce Jones's murder, and Chu, all encapsulated in a PowerPoint presentation he later sent me. He contacted the Australian authorities after learning of LaRue's Australian citizenship. They told him that they, and the Americans, were also looking at LaRue. Chu was released on bail and quickly disappeared. A judge let the case drop. Weeks later, a relative of the man who had tipped the police off to Chu in the first place, whom Inspector R knew only as Cheeto, called to report that Cheeto, too, had gone missing. Then Inspector R discovered that one of his own officers was under surveillance. "Delivery people were showing up at his house with food he'd never ordered," he said, "and people in his neighborhood had been offered money for information about him." After the police concluded that both Chu and the tipster were likely dead, they dropped the case. But Inspector R kept going. A year and a half after the DEA's Kent Bailey had traveled to Manila and begged authorities to put LaRue under surveillance, Inspector R finally did so. He discovered that LaRue rarely left the two houses he owned in Dasmariñas Village, one of which was running up electric bills five times what could be considered normal. He located an airstrip LaRue had built in Batangas, along the coast of the South China Sea, where he seemed to be moving cargo in and out on small private planes. He discovered that LaRue had also purchased a small island off the eastern shore of the Philippines, facing the Pacific, which Inspector R believed was being used to test explosives. When the target shooter Michael Lontoc was murdered a year later, Inspector R was able to tie it back to LaRue. "He was a friend of mine," he said of Lontoc. "I used to shoot with him." Lontoc's mother's name was on a warehouse owned by LaRue, which Inspector R determined was stocked with airplane parts. Inspector R continued exchanging information with foreign authorities, he said, including the FBI office in Miami and the Australian Federal Police. He gathered tidbits of intelligence from wherever he could get them, including the U.S. Department of Homeland Security, which, according to notes that Inspector R later showed me, was monitoring the illegal activities of LaRue and his cohorts, particularly their involvement in terrorist financing. The Royal Malaysia Police had information that LaRue was transporting methamphetamine hydrochloride and its chemical component in different Southeast Asian transshipment points. All of it added up to a murderous criminal cartel operating openly in the Philippines. But the memos Inspector R sent to his superiors about LaRue were answered with silence. Finally, he decided to bypass the chain of command and send a report to the general in charge of the entire Philippine National Police. The general didn't mince words. "I'm not interested," he said. "Make yourself busy with other things." That was LaRue's style, Inspector R told me. If somebody was investigating him, he would find a way to make sure they go easy on him. He would just go up the ladder. He knew how the system worked here. Inspector R's experience reminded me of a story one of LaRue's most trusted mercenaries once told me. One day in a meeting, he said, LaRue casually recounted a time when a woman declined to fulfill a certain sexual desire of his. So he beat her up with a baseball bat, the mercenary told me. I never saw it. I just heard a story from him, and it was confirmed afterwards by the other employees. The woman, he said, turned out to be the daughter of a senator. It was a big, big, big deal. Of course you can't beat up a senator's daughter. That's not going to happen. In the Philippines, you're gone. Or you're going to a hellhole for the rest of your life. Because that's the kind of people you don't touch. But in the end, LaRue turned his grotesque violence to his own advantage, or so the story went. He invited the senator to his office and offered him $2 or $3 million and a spot on the payroll as compensation for your baby girl. The senator accepted it all, the mercenary said, because that was LaRue, his power in the Philippines. He had, not the president, but up the chain, right hands of the president, commanders, generals. He had the Filipino staff working in the U.S. Embassy on the payroll. That's how he knew everything that was going on. Inspector R had long since left the case by the time we met, but he remained troubled, if not surprised, by the ease with which LaRue seemed to have bought his way out of any threat. "He's always in my head," Inspector R said. "Paul LaRue can get away, maybe, maybe, but God will find a way." There was one person who I hoped could still shed light on the Jones murder and on the chain of disappearances that followed, John Nash, the Subic Bay enforcer and former Ocean Adventure security chief, who was one of the last people to see both Jones and Zuniga alive. But Nash, too, proved out of reach for a different reason. On a late Friday afternoon in May 2015, Nash had been headed down a narrow beachside road near Baloy Beach, just outside the Blue Rock Resort in Subic Bay. Suddenly, an SUV appeared in front of him, blocking his path. Before he could reverse, another closed in on him from behind. A half dozen agents from the MBI leaped out, weapons in hand, and ordered Nash out of his vehicle. Within moments, they'd hustled him into one of the unmarked SUVs and were on the highway for the drive back to Manila. Suspecting that Nash had sources in the police, the MBI had kept the operation secret, so successfully, in fact, that the next morning the local police announced that Nash had been kidnapped by unknown armed men. The reason for Nash's arrest was perhaps even more peculiar than its circumstances. When the NBI began pursuing Nash as a person of interest in the Zuniga case, they checked his American passport with the U.S. Embassy. The identity turned out to belong to a long-deceased American named John Nash. The embassy canceled the passport, and the NBI made the arrest. By the time I sat down with Agent Luguet, Nash had been in NBI limbo for more than 18 months. There hadn't been enough information to charge him with anything other than immigration violations, but since Nash wouldn't say where he was from, the MBI had nowhere to deport him to. They declined to let me see him. Nor did anyone seem to have known Nash by any other name. What's more, Timothy Desmond, the Free Willy trainer who had hired Nash to run security, was now himself an international fugitive. In November 2014, after being accused of defrauding an investor behind Ocean Adventure, Desmond, too, had disappeared. There seemed to be no end to the weirdness. Since I couldn't get in to visit Nash, I decided to go see what I could find out about him in Subic. It was a 3-hour trip from Manila, and as Almendral and I descended out of lush mountains with the driver we'd hired for the day, we could see the footprint of the former U.S. naval base. A local reporter suggested we inquire after Nash at the Blue Rock Resort, where Dave Smith had been a regular. Turning up the shore, we passed the pink facade of the Subic Bay Yacht Club, where Oz had embarked on his boat trip with Smith. The Blue Rock turned out to be a large, open-air joint on the beach, with a floating bar just offshore, reached by a hand-pulled ferry. On a weekday afternoon, it was populated largely by leathery white guys, scattered at tables or wandering out to the beach with Filipino women who looked half their age, or less. The blenders were humming with tropical drinks. Almendral and I sat at the bar and ordered a round. Then I ginned up the nerve to approach a table full of hulking, burned-out men sitting mostly in silence. They turned out to be Australian and claimed never to have heard of John Nash. A woman who appeared to be the manager would only say, "I haven't seen him around in a couple of years." We got a similar reaction up the road at Ocean Adventure, where patrons were streaming out at the end of the day's last dolphin show. When we introduced ourselves at the gate, a PR person emerged and proceeded to claim no recollection of Nash or even Desmond, then politely declined to answer any questions. The roads were empty and unlit as we drove back, winding through the forest and the hills above Subic. Suddenly we turned a corner and there was a policeman standing in the street, waving a baton for us to pull over. After months of hearing about the ties between LaRue and corrupt police, Almendral and I both wondered if we'd somehow triggered a trap. But there was nothing to do but stop. The officer stood behind our car and motioned for our driver to exit, which she did, walking back into the darkness behind us. We sat silently, trying to remain calm, and I thought back to the warnings I'd been given about the danger of LaRue's former network. It seemed appropriately farcical that the threat would finally arrive while I was in pursuit of an interview with a rogue celebrity whale trainer. I put not only myself but all three of us in peril, it appeared, chasing a tangent so ludicrous I could barely explain it. A few minutes later, the driver returned. The cop had been freelancing. He just wanted a standard bribe of 50 Philippine pesos, about a dollar. She climbed back in, and we drove on into the night. Chapter 19. The Mercenaries, the Operators. 2010 to 2011. McConnell and Oz looking for exits. Dave Smith gets caught, a South African hitman. RX Limited under pressure. McConnell's new duties. A mental breakdown. Even after all Lachlan McConnell had seen since he started working for LaRue in 2008, the assassination of Bruce Jones still shocked him. They weren't close friends, but he'd sailed with Jones, who, like him, seemed like the kind of guy who'd just fallen into a lucrative job with a few moral ambiguities attached. They'd shared the adventure of the Mumantai sinking in Indonesia, and McConnell had become friendly with Jones's wife. They didn't deserve that, he thought. But more shocking than the loss was the knowledge of how quickly LaRue could turn on you, and the ferocity of the revenge he would exact when he did. McConnell had reason to believe he might end up in its crosshairs. His friend and boss Dave Smith had been, quote, borrowing and spending LaRue's gold for months, and McConnell had agreed to hold on to some of the proceeds for safekeeping. If someone discovered the stash, he'd have no way to explain it. The next time he saw LaRue, McConnell found the nerve to challenge him about Jones's killing. I said, "I don't understand why you had that captain killed," he recalled later. "He was going to testify," LaRue replied. "His wife and child were in the car," McConnell said. "I didn't have them killed," LaRue said. The exchange was enough for McConnell to consider quitting. Many of his gold shepherding duties in Hong Kong were now handled by a trio of Israelis, led by Doran Shulman, who had purchased two houses that were used exclusively for stashing gold. Shulman, a dual Australian-Israeli citizen, was one of a number of LaRue's employees who had served together in the Dove Divan, the elite division of the Israeli Defense Forces. The Dove Divan, which means cherry in Hebrew, specializes in undercover work in Palestinian communities in the West Bank and Gaza. Most famously, its agents have dressed as Arabs to infiltrate Palestinian militant groups and capture or kill high-value targets. LaRue seemed to enjoy the cachet of hiring ex-Special Forces soldiers, and Shulman and his young compatriots got to see the world on LaRue's dime. McConnell, on the other hand, had a family in the Philippines. He didn't need the risks anymore. He could start his own security outfit with more mainstream clients. But how to quit an organization where the act of quitting was cause for suspicion? Halfway around the world in Israel, on the pharmaceutical side of LaRue's business, Moran Oz had also been looking for a way out. Many of the Israelis that he and Alon Berkman had sent to work for LaRue in Manila had since returned, desperate to get away from what they saw there. "They came back from the Philippines with fear in their eyes," one former Tel Aviv employee said. Levi Kugel, the guitar-playing call center manager LaRue had sent to deal with Ari Ben-Menashe, told Oz that he'd left the organization in fear after Ben-Menashe had failed to deliver a diplomatic passport for LaRue. Kugel, afraid the boss might exact vengeance on him, moved to the United States, where he assumed he would be out of reach. Asaf Shoshana, the childhood friend of Oz's and former Dove Divan soldier who was running LaRue's timber operations, told Oz that LaRue had abruptly abandoned the projects. Paul refused to wire the money, and that was the end, Oz recalled. When local police started looting the equipment at one work site, Shoshana suspected he might be arrested and fled. He said that he called LaRue and told him that he was done. "There's no such thing as done," LaRue replied. "You work for me until I fire you, or something else." Shoshana told Oz that he feared LaRue was planning to kill him. Oz persuaded his boss to instead send Shoshana back to Tel Aviv to help run the call center. From there, it was easier to quit. But even Israel began to seem unsafe for anyone who crossed LaRue. Employees believed that he had connections in the Israeli mafia through Shai Reuven, and there were stories to back it up. After an employee named Omer Bezalel told LaRue that he wanted to quit, two men with guns showed up at Bezalel's home with pictures of his relatives in the United States. "Your job is important to Paul," they told him. "You can't leave." Oz would later claim that he was trapped, working under duress, unable to quit for fear that LaRue would come after him and his family, which now included two kids. But he was also thriving at the company, making great money, enough to help support his extended family and give to the community. In the year since Oz and Alon Berkman traveled to Kenya in 2009, their responsibilities with RX Limited only increased. LaRue had expanded his operations in Israel and opened the marketing call center in Maharashtra, India, with 150 employees. "On a day-to-day basis, he didn't seem so scared," said one of Oz's deputies in Israel. "He projected that he was king of the world, making 50 to 100 grand a month. But of course there's more to the story." In Manila, Dave Smith appeared unconcerned about LaRue's vengeance and became increasingly brazen about his stealing. His lack of discretion seemed particularly ill-advised, his fellow mercenaries thought, given that the boss was known to order disloyal employees dead. The fact that Smith himself was often the one ordered to carry out those killings had, perhaps, made him overconfident. But there he was, out on P. Burgos Street, the central artery of Manila's red light district, in a Lamborghini. He'd also bought a carbon fiber Mercedes, custom-built for racing and shipped in from Germany, a Hummer, and a McLaren. He'd purchased a mansion in a Tony suburb of Manila where LaRue himself owned a house. He bought the million-dollar place in Alabang, had these exotic cats, and he was going around town splashing money everywhere, Patrick Donovan, Smith's former employer and fellow Irishman, said. "I mean, fuck me. You're gonna steal money from someone. You stash that shit away. You keep your lifestyle as it is." Dave was skimming drugs, he was skimming gold, another employee of LaRue's and a friend of Smith's said. "I remember driving with Dave to see LaRue, and he would park way down the street. I said, 'Why are you parking this far away?' He said, 'You know boss wants us to keep a low profile.'" They'd all been warned against flaunting their money in ways that might attract the authorities. No Rolexes, no flashy cars, no drugs. Smith ignored all three prohibitions. In late 2010, Smith began acting even more strangely. He told the friend cryptically that he was getting some accounts in order, almost as if he had a terminal disease. "Then I couldn't get a hold of him," the friend said. "And that wasn't Dave. He would call me 10 times a day. His wife couldn't find him. So I emailed LaRue. I got a response. 'Call me. Here's my number.'" "What's going on?" LaRue asked nonchalantly when the friend called. "Have you seen Dave?" "I sent him to South America a few days ago," LaRue said. "He's going to be out of contact for a while. You'll report directly to me." The friend knew something was wrong. Days later, he got another call from LaRue, ordering him to fly to the Philippines and meet at the Mandarin Oriental Hotel. When they sat down, LaRue told him that he had placed Dave on permanent vacation. Those are the exact words he used. He was always very careful. I asked him why. Paul said, "You have to understand, I have partners in Colombia. Dave was stealing from me. If I didn't take care of this, they would take care of me." Then he said to me, "You ever try and steal from me, you ever try to get out, and I will liquidate you." There were varying accounts floating around the LaRue mercenary community of how Smith ultimately met his end. McConnell later heard that he had been snatched, drunk, off of P. Burgos Street, thrown into a van, and driven to a remote location. My understanding was that he was placed in a shallow grave and given a telephone, McConnell said. LaRue, according to this version, was on the other end of the line. He says, "You see what happens?" Then they shot him and buried him. Another version claimed that Mexican cartel hitmen had been brought in for the job. Still another had it that LaRue had him thrown off a boat, much as Moran Oz had been, except with fatal consequences. The actual facts matched pieces of the rumors, but with one key difference. LaRue had been present for the job, together with a former South African policeman named Marcus. I tracked down Marcus on LinkedIn, where he listed Southern Ace on his employment profile. When I told him what I'd heard about Dave Smith's murder, he seemed almost relieved to confess the details to me. "I've done some pretty horrible shit with him," he said of LaRue. "You know, what can I say? I was there, I was involved, my life was pretty fucked up." LaRue had first hired Marcus in the summer of 2010, he said, after he responded to an email forwarded by a fellow South African security contractor. The note was from an organization seeking close-in, security, or snipers, ready to deploy to Manila or Somalia. "I was down and out," Marcus told me. He had left the police force and gone into private security. "Then one or two things happened and my whole life fell apart. I couldn't find work. I was financially fucked. So it was a stupid move to get involved. But fuck, I did." 7 days later, he was in Manila, where he was hired by LaRue directly, outside of the purview of Smith and his teams. "It was so secretive, if anything went wrong, I was on my own," Marcus said. "There was no connection between him and me, nothing. I eventually had a Filipino guy working with me, but I was kept in the dark. They hid me in hotels, and then they would send people to go and fetch me." Marcus's initial job was to surveil employees LaRue believed were betraying him. He traveled to Bulawayo, hunting for LaRue's cousin Matthew Smith, only to conclude that the cousin had spotted him and gone into hiding. Then LaRue ordered him to look into a real estate agent named Catherine Lee, who he claimed had stolen money in a failed real estate transaction, about 50 million pesos, or just under $1 million. "He wanted to get some of the money back and find all the details," Marcus told me. "So first I had to find her, and then I almost had like a relationship with her, trying to get information out of her. I took her out to dinner a couple of times. We had a whole fucking thing going." I asked him if he thought Lee had in fact stolen money from LaRue. No, he said. "The way she was living, I doubted it. She didn't live the lifestyle of somebody that had a lot of money. But you know, with Paul, once he believed that you stole from him, it doesn't matter what you say. There's no negotiations." Before LaRue could deal with Lee, however, he had a more pressing matter. Dave Smith was stealing from him and flaunting it. "He said Dave stole a lot of gold from him and sold it," Marcus said. "And Dave lived the lifestyle of a very rich guy. I mean, he had all these girlfriends and houses and cars. It was unbelievable." Finally, LaRue decided he'd had enough. One day in December 2010, he told Smith that they needed to bury a stash of gold on his coastal property in Batangas, south of Manila. LaRue and Marcus picked him up in a truck with a safe in the back and drove him to the property. As Smith started to dig the hole, Marcus walked up behind him, pulled out a 9mm handgun, and shot him in the head. Smith collapsed, but was still alive. Marcus tried to finish the job, but his gun jammed. Smith began screaming as LaRue and Marcus worked to fix the gun. Then, as if on cue, a group of stray dogs appeared and began running toward them. While LaRue chased them off, Marcus unjammed the gun and fired several more shots into Smith's head. LaRue, seemingly eager to get in on the kill, grabbed an MP5 submachine gun and pumped more rounds into the lifeless body. "That he didn't hit me was a fucking miracle," Marcus said. "But there's so much adrenaline going through at that stage. It was only later when I went back to my hotel and I was thinking about what we did that I thought, I can't believe that this guy didn't shoot me." LaRue had already made plans to dispose of Smith's body offshore. "It's very bad, I know, but some of that stuff was actually funny," Marcus said. "After we did the job, he gave me a fucking roll of Glad Wrap to wrap Dave's body. And I said, are you fucking crazy? You can't do that." Instead, Marcus took a canvas cover from a nearby boat and wrapped the body up. They loaded it onto a rubber dinghy attached to one of LaRue's boats and launched them both into the South China Sea. Somewhere 5 to 10 kilometers from shore, they stopped and pushed the body overboard. It didn't sink. LaRue told Marcus to jump in and cut holes in the canvas. I was too scared, Marcus said. I just thought, if I dive in, then the cunt is either going to shoot me or he's going to leave me there. Instead, he handed his knife to LaRue, who jumped overboard to slash the canvas wrapped around his recently murdered employee. In a bit of futile, posthumous revenge, Dave Smith still refused to sink. So they removed the motor from the dinghy, tied it to the canvas, and watched the body slowly disappear. On the return trip to shore, Marcus and LaRue got lost and then trapped on a reef. And after an hour of battling the waves, they pulled up on a resort beach several kilometers from LaRue's property. Before catching a cab back to the truck, they ordered beers at a beachside bar. Within weeks of this episode in late 2010, LaRue and Marcus together carried out two more murders. Herbert Tan Chu, the gun runner arrested weeks earlier by Inspector R, and Cheeto, the man who tipped off the authorities to Chu's gun stash. Each was lured, on separate occasions, to LaRue's property, his killing fields, Marcus called it, with promises that he was being relocated to an island for his own safety. Once in the car, LaRue and Marcus would handcuff their target and interrogate him about helping Smith steal gold. At the property, each man was forced at gunpoint onto a boat. Once out to sea, Cheeto leapt into the water and Marcus shot him. Chu was less cooperative, so LaRue shot him with a taser and Marcus pushed him overboard. As Chu pleaded for his life, Marcus ended it. This time, they remembered to bring an anchor to weigh down the body. LaRue's paranoia over the disloyalty of employees was in full bloom, and he began to see traitors everywhere he looked. Not that there wasn't a kernel of truth in his concern. Filipino employees had always known that some of LaRue's money was slipping outside doors. That was just part of doing business. While the foreigners he imported from America and Israel blundered around the country, largely naive about Philippine culture beyond bar girls and government bribes, some local hires were quietly finding ways to exploit their boss. Managing call centers was my job description, one Filipino employee told me. But he would give me odd jobs, like, find me a nightclub to buy. I looked for so many properties for Paul. I earned money from that, but I didn't think it was stealing. I took commissions, which was only fair. LaRue, who seemed to be unable or unwilling to distinguish between betrayal and skimming, added her to his hit list. Paul was looking in the wrong direction, she said. He should have looked closer. After Marcus's first three hits, LaRue ordered him to kill one of the organization's attorneys, a Filipina who had tried and failed to get the cargo ship MV Ufuk returned to him. But he deemed the plan Marcus came up with too elaborate and called off the hit. Marcus left for South Africa, he told me, and never returned. I asked him if he ever thought about the killings later. In the beginning, I had pretty bad nightmares, he said. But also for me, coming from my background as a policeman, you shoot people. My mindset was, don't think of it any other way. It's just a job. LaRue told him that these people had committed crimes against him. He wasn't the judge, he said. Just the man carrying out the verdict. Call it a police mentality if you want. These people, they stole, they robbed, they killed. Only difference is, we executed them. I tried to block that shit out of my mind. But yeah, it's something that I don't like to talk about. One afternoon in January 2011, Lachlan McConnell was summoned to meet LaRue at one of his favorite Manila spots, the Hard Rock Cafe, in a Makati mall. McConnell knew that LaRue had recently ordered an audit of his gold stashes, and Dave Smith had been missing for weeks, presumed dead. LaRue had replaced Smith with Joseph Hunter, who was taking over the security team. If there had been a time to get out, McConnell had already missed it. He showed up early and ordered a rum and coke to steel his nerves. When LaRue arrived, he was carrying a stack of file folders and motioned McConnell to an empty section of the restaurant. When they sat down, he slid a folder across the table. I think you know what this is about, McConnell remembered him saying. I kind of do, McConnell said. LaRue told him he knew about Smith's stealing and McConnell's part in it. So how much gold did he give you? Looking down at the folder, McConnell decided it was best to come clean. First of all, he didn't give me gold, he told LaRue. He wanted to take the gold, utilize it, and pay it back. I told Dave to just ask you for a loan. I know you're pretty generous. You would have probably done it. I should have kept Dave in a cage, LaRue said. McConnell asked if LaRue was responsible for Smith's disappearance. Yes, yes, LaRue said dismissively. We killed him. LaRue demanded banking information for accounts that McConnell had used to stash Smith's money, along with his ATM cards. McConnell would repay every cent, LaRue told him, deducted from his paycheck. Then he picked up the folder, pulled out pictures of Smith's girlfriends, and asked McConnell if he knew where any of them lived. LaRue told McConnell that from that point forward, he was going to be assigned to new duties in the United States, opening shell companies for the pharmaceutical side of the business. "I didn't need Dave," he said. "You're lucky I need you." The reason LaRue needed McConnell stemmed from a growing set of problems that Oz and Berkman were encountering with RX Limited. In 2011, the online pill business was getting squeezed by the companies handling its credit card payments, known as merchant processors. Afraid that they might be liable for payments on illegal drug sales, the merchant processors began demanding that RX Limited prove it was accredited by a National Association of Boards of Pharmacy program called Verified Internet Pharmacy Practice Site. The VIPS system, as it was known, had been established to bring some order to the Wild West of online drug sales. It was a way to certify which websites were abiding by the DEA's regulations. FedEx, RX Limited's main conduit for shipping pills, began issuing similar demands that RX Limited prove its VIPS certification. The pharmacies themselves had also started getting antsy. The business had become high risk, one pharmacist in Michigan told Oz. The DEA was watching, and sometimes raiding, pharmacies in the RX Limited network. Others complained that the wholesale pharmacies supplying them were starting to get spooked by the quantities of Ultram, Soma, and Fioricet dispensed by mom-and-pop drugstores. The brilliant model that LaRue had created was suddenly under threat from multiple sides. His expansion plans were floundering. The call center in India was mismanaged and dysfunctional. Despite having more than 50 employees per site, they were producing fewer orders than